had the chance to call SB 8 for what it is, a blatant violation of the constitutional rights of nearly 7 million Texans. But from voting rights to housing rights to reproductive freedom, it is clear that the courts are not on the people's side, but this Congress is. So Congress has a responsibility to act. This is our moment to make this pro-choice Democratic majority House, Senate, and White House be more than a talking point.
That was Congresswoman Ayanna Pressley, chair of the Pro-Choice Caucus's Abortion Rights and Access Task Force. She was speaking last week about the Women's Health Protection Act, which passed in the House of Representatives. Now, the bill would make abortion access a federal right and override the growing number of abortion bans that have been passed at the state level, including SB 8 in Texas. But as with many key components of the Democrat-controlled House's agenda, the Women's Health Protection Act has almost no chance of getting enough votes to pass in the Senate, which means that the most meaningful fights against anti-abortion legislation will be happening outside the halls of Congress. I'm Melissa Harris-Perry, and today on The Takeaway, we start with a look at the nationwide strategy for abortion rights advocates. Alexis McGill Johnson is the president of Planned Parenthood Federation of America, and I spoke with her about the passage of the Women's Health Protection Act.
This was an absolutely historic vote. We want to actually thank the House for passing Women's Health Protection Act. It is such an important step to protect access to safe and legal abortion across this country. It would help guard against the crazy abortion bans that we have seen, other medically unnecessary restrictions like the ones passed in Texas and across the country. And, you know, it's one of many steps that we need to see to truly protect and advance abortion access.
Now, of course, any of us who are paying attention to the world or Washington, D.C., know that no matter what is happening in the House, the likelihood of almost anything, but especially this, passing through the Senate seems highly unlikely. Does that in any way deter its relevance?
You know, the reality is the majority of Americans actually support access to safe and legal abortion, right? There is no state in the nation where banning abortion is popular. And we have seen 600 restrictions introduced in 2021 alone. 90 of them have been enacted. And I recognize the fact that, you know, the momentum is on our side. We saw this historic vote. And there are a number of champions in the Senate, like the bill sponsors, like Senator Blumenthal, Senator Baldwin, Senator Murray. They are talking to their colleagues. And we are going to be marching in the streets. As you know, on October 2nd, thousands of people across the country are coming together to rally for abortion justice. And so we will make, you know, our voices heard to senators, and we will send them a clear message that people want their elected officials to allow them the freedom to make their own healthcare decisions. And when you look at the overreach in Texas on an unconstitutional ban, extreme ban at that, it is really galvanizing a lot of people, and they will be on the record. These senators will be on the record voting. So they need to do it within, you know, the spirit of where they're elected constituencies are.
So when you make this point about the October 2nd rally, this kind of public demonstration of what has long been understood as the public opinion, right, that, you know, a majority of Americans support access to abortion care and support legal and safe abortion care. Talk to me then about strategy. So you've got, you know, the House of Representatives passing legislative action, even if it can't get to the Senate. You've got sort of a movement into, you know, sort of the movement politics, right, onto the streets in early October. Watching what is happening in conversation with the national players, what in the world is the strategy?
Well, I mean, look, let's see. First of all, we have SB 8 in Texas, right, which is this blatantly unconstitutional 6-week ban with this bounty hunter provision. We have the Supreme Court taking up a case in Mississippi, which is a, you know, also unconstitutional 15-week ban, which goes to the essence of Roe. So you essentially have like a de facto strategy where we could see a copy set of copycat laws out of Texas and about 25 other states over the next cycle of state legislative sessions. And then you also have the Supreme Court case. And so the strategy, right, the movement strategy is to help people understand that that this is not just about Texas or Mississippi, right? This is about the impact that banning abortion could happen at our doorsteps, right? I mean, that we need to be fighting in all of these states to awaken people to what we have been saying for at least the last decade in earnest, but really for the last 50 years almost since Roe was decided, that the end game is to ban abortion. And so we are, we will be able to sustain this conversation starting now through the oral arguments, through many a state legislative session, and through the decision day. And that is going to drive a conversation about access to abortion all the way through the election. And so we are in education mobilization phase. There will be an accountability phase as well. And that's why I think it's really important for the Senate to be taking up WIPA, because there will be accountability in those votes. And people will need to understand why their electeds made a decision to not stand with the nearly 25 million women who will lose access to a provider in their state.
Help folks to understand why it seems to make so little difference who controls the House or who controls the White House to the actual restriction of reproductive access. So it's always so surprising to me to look at those Guttmacher charts and see the ways that, you know, even with a Democratic president, even with a Democratic House and Senate, you see so many new abortion restrictions. And in fact, sometimes even faster, right, under Democratic federal leadership. What in the world is going on with that?
Well, I mean, we don't have laws like WIPA in place, to federal legislation that would help codify Roe and stop these bans from happening. But what you really have is a long-term power grab at the state level that really in earnest took hold in 2010. Remember the 2010 Congress and the census redistricting that swept a lot of the state houses. And you have, as I said earlier, there's no state in the union where banning abortion is popular. And yet in state after state, particularly in the South and the Midwest, you have state legislatures that are dominated by a vocal minority. They have the levers of power. And so when I look at my involvement in this work, I came into the board 2010, and I feel like we're at halftime, right? That that part of our work is around power building in the states and recognizing the fact that we won't be able to pursue many freedoms, right? Not just access to abortion. These are the same states that are restricting access to voting rights. They're the same states that are restricting trans rights. And so it really is, even in spite of having, essentially Congress and the White House, we still have these restrictions on the state level because these lawmakers are protected and out of touch with their constituents.
So, Alexis, I want to transition, certainly still within this conversation, but I do want to ask you a little bit about sort of your own professional history around this and just kind of see if I could figure out a few things. So the first is that you have been really clear that in your leadership of Planned Parenthood, part of what you are up to, one of the things you are hoping to do with the organization, not like y'all don't have plenty enough else to do, is to expand and diversify in a very forward-facing way, the way that Planned Parenthood understands its own relationship, its own history with communities of color and others. So can you talk to me a little bit about why that matters in the context of this fight? Why does it matter to go back and really think about the ways that race, the ways that economic disadvantage, and interestingly enough, sort of the ways that even the potential narrowness of the definition woman, or those capable of reproduction, right, who need reproductive care, how does all of that fit into this existential battle that Planned Parenthood finds itself in right now?
Yeah. Thank you for that question, Melissa. It is, I think, the most critical thing I can be focused on in this moment, recognizing the fact that Planned Parenthood at 105 years old almost is a critical part of the public health infrastructure. It is a critical part of the healthcare system. And we know that, our patients, many of them BIPOC, low income, deserve an incredible, non-judgmental quality of care. And in order for us to do that, it means that we not only need to, you know, ensure that we are doing everything we can to reduce bias and racial anxiety and, you know, things like that inside of their healthcare provision, but also that, you know, as our patients come to us for things like gender affirming care or, you know, family planning or access to abortion, we know that when they leave, they are subject to any number of injustices when they walk out of our doors. So really standing with our patients and centering them really calls us to do work and show up differently so that we are also standing inside of the movement differently, centering different voices, as well as standing with our a broader set of partners so that we can ensure protection of our patients beyond sexual and reproductive health care.
Not everyone may know this, but you have a little bit of a hip hop background too. And some of your work within organizing and movement leading was in part about engaging communities that at the time were young. We've aged now, but younger communities in addressing questions of the capacity to vote and to turn out and have your voices heard. And I've always thought part of what was so interesting about that moment was bringing in voices that were unexpected and simply in their unexpectedness, right? Drawing some attention. I'm wondering if you're thinking about that relative to this fight as well. Are there some unexpected voices we need to be hearing from? Like, where is country music? Where is hip hop on advocating for abortion access? Where are the young and the elderly? Have you been thinking about those kinds of voices?
Absolutely. I mean, look, I think that part of our charge this year as a movement and as a leader in that conversation is to first center the voices of the patients, center the voices of the people who are being most disproportionately impacted by these bans, people who could be disproportionately impacted if Roe is overturned. And so, you know, I do think that, you know, artists and celebrities and folks like that that I've worked with over the decades are both privately outraged and also grappling with what the public outcry might be. And, you know, I think that has been the strategy of those folks who are anti-abortion. The strategy of the antis has been to shame anyone who fights for a freedom to make a decision about one's own body.
Alexis McGill Johnson is the president of Planned Parenthood. Thanks so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me, Melissa.
The Women's Health Protection Act, passed by the House of Representatives late last week, has little chance of becoming law. But there is significant legislative action winding its way through Congress, which addresses women's health and just might find its way into the law. The Black Maternal Health Momnibus package. Now, Momnibus is big, really big. So, for a thorough explanation, I'm turning to Dr. Monica McLemore. She's an associate professor of family healthcare nursing at the University of California, San Francisco, an affiliated scientist with Advancing New Standards in Reproductive Health, and a member of the Bixby Center for Global Reproductive Health. Now, Monica, what exactly is the Momnibus?
The Momnibus was originally introduced by Representative Alma Adams, who is a Democrat from North Carolina, and Representative Lauren Underwood, who is a Democrat from Chicago. And it was originally a package of 9 bills that were put together to really address the Black maternal health crisis here in the United States. And unfortunately, it got released the Monday before the entire nation went on lockdown for COVID-19. So early on in the 117th Congress, Rep. Adams and Rep. Underwood, along with the 200 plus signatories with the Black Maternal Caucus within the House of Representatives, reintroduced the Momnibus. And instead of it being 9 bills, it's now 12. And it included things like paid family leave and perinatal mental health for veterans. And it included 3 new bills that had COVID-19 provisions for individuals. And basically what it is a set of bills and legislation that would really transform reproductive health across multiple spectrums. It has reform in it for payers, for pregnant people who provide pregnancy-related services. It has provisions to look at workforce. It has provisions to look at state maternal child health programs. It is one of the most comprehensive packages of bills for us to really provide comprehensive reproductive health care for pregnant capable people in the United States. And we are so lucky that mid-September, it was included as part of the markup for the Build Back Better initiative. And that it looks like two of the bills, particularly one that was specific to maternal morbidity and mortality review committees, those committees that look at every maternal death, the Kira Johnson Act, named for Charles Johnson's wife, Kira, were earmarked. Those funds were allocated under the Build Back Better markup process in the Energy and Commerce Committee. So this is the first time it will allow us to really help to address the Black maternal health crisis in the United States. And it is a comprehensive set of legislation that we really, really want to be able to see be passed, including some low-hanging fruit like expanding Medicaid for the postpartum period out to a year instead of what it currently is under Medicaid, which is 60 days.
You've referenced a couple times the Black maternal health crisis. What exactly is that?
So in the United States, we've tried to bring awareness to the fact that Black moms are 3 to 4 times more likely to die from pregnancy-related issues, according to data from the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention. And it's estimated that of those between 700 and 900 deaths, that between 50 and 60% of them are preventable. The burden is really born in Black communities and in some geographies in Native and Indigenous communities as well. And the Momnibus really seeks to address many of those upstream and preventable causes.
I want you to talk to me a little bit about nurses and particularly the ways that nursing education may or may not, at least particularly right now, be serving the very communities, the Black mama communities in the broadest sense, that the Momnibus bill is seeking to uplift.
Nursing has both this long history of service and this long history of Black and queer folk, you know, as participants in the workforce. And yet, unfortunately, at the higher echelons of power in nursing, you know, it remains, you know, unbearably white. And it does not reflect the communities that we serve. There have been multiple pathways to nursing education, but we have one national license as registered nurses. And so when I tell people I have 3 degrees from public institutions and I maintain my RN licensure, you know, I always say, yes, I'm a doctorally prepared nurse. But when I think about the entry to practice that I obtained, which was the Baccalaureate of Science in Nursing, I have worked with associate degree nurses. I have worked with community college nurses. I have worked with master's nurses. When you further complicate this around pregnant capable people, I would be remiss if I didn't say anything about the midwives and the discrediting of the grand midwives, particularly those of which who were mostly Black. When you think about nurse midwifery and professional midwifery, it's no different. There are multiple pathways to become midwives. And one of the things that the Momnibus does address is this idea that we want to reinvest in the Black midwifery workforce, because we know that midwives and doulas, in partnership with communities and patients, get superior outcomes when we're talking about pregnant capable people. That said, we have not been able to structurally diversify the nursing workforce. And this was further highlighted and borne out by the recent Future of Nursing report, and that there are direct instructions for schools of nursing, for professional organizations in nursing, for the National Institutes of Nursing Research, which is under the National Institutes of Health, to diversify our workforce as a potential path to improve health outcomes. So the story of nursing is both one of needing a reckoning, but also one of opportunity, one of excitement, and one of, if we can really get beyond our shameful history, then I think we actually have a prime opportunity to do some really good work. If we wanted to be able to diversify, midwifery could easily be built now. There are no midwifery programs at any historic Black college or university. If we wanted to rapidly diversify the midwifery workforce, we would build paths to historically Black colleges and universities who already have health sciences on their campus.
Okay, Monica, my next question is, how does abortion and the access to safely terminate pregnancies fit into this broader understanding of maternal health care?
We know from national polling that Americans have been supportive of abortion rights, and are supportive of people being able to have timely and safe and community-based abortion care. For the first time ever, in a Supreme Court case that potentially could overturn Roe versus Wade and has implications for Casey and Obergefell, the gay marriage decision, there is a Black maternal health amicus brief that was led by the National Birth Equity Collaborative and our good friend and colleague, Dr. Joya Carrier-Perry and her team was really happy to sign on to this to make the argument that's grounded in reproductive justice, that the state's rights, and this is specific to the case of Mississippi, does not trump human rights or bodily autonomy of individuals. And so this issue around abortion, this issue around fetal rights, this issue around viability is being couched incorrectly because the state's interest in termination of pregnancy does not trump the human right to bodily autonomy in life and in death that we all currently have as a human right. No one can go dig up your corpse when you're dead and take your organs without your consent, right? So if we have bodily autonomy in life and death, and these are human rights that we are afforded, then the state's right in Mississippi does not trump that human right. When we look at the SB 8 in Texas, virtually banning abortion at 6 weeks and deputizing citizens and private individuals to be able to bring lawsuits against people who aid and abet people seeking essential abortion care and exercising their right to bodily autonomy, we are looking at a step backwards in terms of how we think about operationalizing reproductive justice and human rights in the United States. And I was very glad to see, corporate individuals. I was very glad to see people step up to want to defend the right of individuals to access abortion care in the state of Texas, in the state of Mississippi. We also saw a similar law to the state in Texas be introduced in Florida last week. We need to be very clear with people that states' rights do not trump human rights, and that the human right to bodily autonomy is consistent with reproductive justice. And that is the way that we will end the Black maternal health crisis in the United States, is to respect the bodily autonomy and to trust Black women, Black birthing people, and other pregnant capable individuals.
Can you expand for me just a little bit the sort of phrase women's health, or our assumption that reproductive health is always about women, where women is pretty narrowly defined as cisgendered folks? What happens when we expand that definition?
What we are trying to achieve is, gender inclusive language to recognize that not all people who birth or have capacity to do so identify as women, that not all people who have capacity to birth are actually ever going to birth, and that we really are trying to get at a better taxonomy to talk about a variety of issues that impact people regardless of what their reproductive capacity is. And that's why reproductive justice is so important, because it really allows us to have that precision that we're seeking in our language. Women's health is a component, but not comprehensive, of reproductive health and reproductive well-being. And so we don't want to be exclusionary at all. We want to make sure that, LGBTQIA folks and non-binary folks and people who don't necessarily even believe in gender understand that there are health services that we all should expect and have a right to under human rights. And so one of the things that I think is really, really important that we think about is the language that we use when we're talking about you know, services across the reproductive spectrum and to have some precision in that language.
Dr. Monica McLemore is the Associate Professor of Family Healthcare Nursing at the University of California, San Francisco. Thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
Okay, y'all, we wanted to hear from you on this as well. What has been your experience with reproductive health care? Have you felt seen and heard by your healthcare providers?
Hi, this is Emily from Alexandria, Virginia. I have been on some form of birth control, with the exception of two pregnancies, for about 20 years. I am thoroughly pro-choice, but my husband is not. He is a devout Catholic. It's something I try and respect. We just agree to disagree at which point in a pregnancy life begins.
Hi, this is Ifa Kolade Reese, and I'm calling from Las Vegas, Nevada. About 15 years ago, my then wife was pregnant, and the pregnancy threatened to compromise her health, that it might have killed her. And so I had to go with her, and she actually had to have a medical abortion performed. It was a very solemn moment for us. At the same time, I'm glad that we did have the resources to be able to keep her alive, and she's still alive today.
Hi, this is Jasmine from San Diego. It took me 2 years and three OBGYNs to get an IUD. The first two refused because I, quote, had not used my uterus yet. I was 25 and can't imagine having a child at that time in my life. Instead of an IUD, I was prescribed multiple types of birth control that made me very ill. I finally found a good OB who listened and immediately scheduled my IUD. And I'm now 31 and I still don't have any kids. So I'm very thankful.
I'm June from Corning, New York. And I want to say that Planned Parenthood was very important to me when I was in college. It gave me safe, secure exams and provide birth control responsibly.
I've been able to take my reproductive health care for granted. Growing up with rights, I used Planned Parenthood for birth control, yearly exams, and a termination of an unwanted pregnancy when I was 18, as well as the morning after pill in my 40s. I've used them before having health insurance and after having private insurance. I had private insurance before having my child and now into menopause. I've weaved Planned Parenthood in and out of my care when I wanted privacy. I can't imagine not being able to make choices about what I want to do with my body based on my current situation in life. I've had so much freedom to choose, and I worry for the future fertile-aged woman who won't have the freedoms I did. It's wrong.
Thank you so much for sharing your stories with us. And you can continue telling us about your experiences with reproductive health care at 877-869-8253. Or send us a voice memo at takeawaycallers@gmail.com. We always love to hear from you.
WNYC Studios is supported by Rocket Money. Did you know nearly 75% of people have subscriptions they've forgotten about? Rocket Money is a personal finance app that finds and cancels your unwanted subscriptions, monitors your spending, and helps lower your bills so that you can grow your savings. Rocket Money will even try to negotiate your bills for you by up to 20%. All you have to do is submit a picture of your bill, and Rocket Money takes care of the rest. Rocket Money has over 5 million users and has saved a total of $500 million in canceled subscriptions, saving members up to $740 a year when using all of the app's features. Stop wasting money on things you don't use. Cancel your unwanted subscriptions by going to rocketmoney.com/WNYC. That's rocketmoney.com/WNYC.
You come to the New Yorker Radio Hour for conversations that go deeper with people you really want to hear from, whether it's Bruce Springsteen or Questlove or Olivia Rodrigo, Liz Cheney, or the godfather of artificial intelligence, Geoffrey Hinton, or some of my extraordinarily well-informed colleagues at The New Yorker. So join us every week on The New Yorker Radio Hour, wherever you listen to podcasts. You're listening to The Takeaway. I'm Melissa Harris-Perry, and we're continuing our conversation about women's health. Let's start with a few troubling statistics. About 16% of Latinas have not visited a doctor in the last 2 years. Latinas are also the group of women most likely to being diagnosed with cervical cancer. And because of higher poverty rates and lower rates of insurance coverage, Latinas have less access to contraception, and more than 50% of pregnancies among Latinas are unintended. Now, despite these startling inequalities, Latinx communities are often excluded from mainstream conversations about reproductive health, which is exactly why Latinx people have organized on their own behalf.
One of the things to know about the Latinx community is that we are resilient. We are leaders in our own fights in our communities. And we are building a future for ourselves that really kind of takes us beyond what the courts throw at us, what our legislatures throw at us.
We spoke with Lupe Rodriguez. She's executive director of the National Latina Institute for Reproductive Justice. And Lupe started by telling me a bit about the stories often missing when it comes to Latinx communities and reproductive health.
I think in terms of, you know, reproductive justice right now, one of the things that's the most incredible for the Latinx community is that, you know, we are living through unprecedented times. As you know, this has been a terrible year for reproductive health rights and justice. And the truth is, of course, that our communities have been struggling for access to reproductive care that includes birth control, preventative screenings, prenatal care, postnatal care, and abortion for decades, right? And so these bans and restrictions that are keeping us from the reproductive health care that we need really are disproportionately hurting our communities, our Black communities, our Indigenous communities. But we're fighting back. And I think that that's part of the story here, that, you know, we've been facing these barriers for a long time and we're fighting back.
You know, when you said this has been a horrible year, I mean, obviously, yes, relative to state legislative action restricting access to abortion and other reproductive rights. But I thought you were going somewhere else. I thought you were going to talk about COVID-19. It occurs to me that it has also been a particularly horrifying sort of year and a half for Black and Latinx communities relative to COVID-19 infections and deaths. Can you talk about the work that your organization does generally, but then in the context of this particular global pandemic moment?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I meant to share exactly that the barriers that we've already been facing to reproductive health care are made worse, of course, by the fact that we lack access to regular health care as it is. And with COVID-19, the effects of all of these inequities that we've faced for a long time have become increasingly stark for our community. We know that this pandemic has undoubtedly affected those with the least resources. We've seen it on the ground in our communities, in the places where we organize at Latina Institute, particularly in states like Florida and Texas, where for years politicians have worked to dismantle safety nets and failed to protect the health of our residents. In states like Florida and Texas specifically, people have been facing this pandemic with less resources and less coverage. They've lost jobs and lost family members to the pandemic. At our own organization, we've had many losses, and our community feels it really, really deeply. And I think the way that this sort of ties into the work that we do at Latina Institute is that we're constantly fighting for access to healthcare for everyone. We really think about the specific and undue effect on immigrant communities as well, because, you know, as many of you know, those communities lack basic access to even, you know, any kind of coverage. Even if you are a legal permanent resident in the U.S., you have to wait 5 years after you have your legal permanent residency in order to be able to have access to Medicare or to CHIP or to other healthcare programs. And many folks don't know also that if you're undocumented in this country, you don't even have access to anything and in many places. And you can't even buy access into the ACA or any other healthcare coverage program. So we really, you know, think about that our communities have been largely impacted by this and even more so than others. And this is just another, you know, that has exacerbated so many of the inequities and made it even worse for what we're facing now in terms of reproductive healthcare, which is part of what we think about at Latina Institute.
So you were talking about the key states where you all work: Florida, New York, Texas, mm-hmm. and Virginia. Can we just go ahead and talk about Texas for a minute?
This year, abortion restrictions have reached a record high. And of course, after Governor Greg Abbott signed the measure that bans abortions in Texas as early as 6 weeks, which is before many people even realize that they're pregnant. You know, Texas now, because of this, has the most restrictive ban on abortion care in the country. And providers every day, we're hearing every day from folks on the ground that providers have been forced to turn countless people away without the care they need. And it's, you know, it's incredible that this law is even in the books, that it's even being upheld. It is incredibly unconstitutional. And we are seeing the effects of it every day right now. I think one thing that I'd like to lift up that we're really thinking about at Latina Institute is about the community members who are not able to leave the state. You know, we're hearing stories of folks who are having to leave the state to get the care they need in record numbers. But there are communities, specifically immigrant, undocumented communities, who cannot leave. Many folks don't know that, especially in the Rio Grande Valley where we are, there are internal checkpoints that keep people from being able to move, and that keep them hostage in the area that they are. I mean, these folks have already had very little access to care, and now are essentially, you know, without any abortion care in the state of Texas.
Talk to me a bit about the attitudes in Latinx communities regarding various aspects of reproductive rights and reproductive justice. I know that at times in doing this work, I'll hear folks say, oh, you know, the Latinx community is all anti-abortion. You know, Catholicism keeps folks from needing or wanting access to these services. And I think that's not right. So help us understand what is right and what the sort of range of experiences and needs are in this community.
Our communities are, well, first of all, not monolithic. So there's that. I think we come from so many different countries. Some of us speak Spanish as a connecting factor, but there are so many different experiences in the community. And absolutely, you know, what we've found over the years through different polls, through our work on the ground, is that our communities want the same thing everybody else does. We want access to healthcare. We want access to jobs. We want to be able to feed our children, to have good schools, and we recognize that includes having access to all of the healthcare we need, including contraception, including abortion care, including the gamut of reproductive healthcare, and specifically around abortion care. Over 70% of our community members believe that abortion should be, you know, safe and accessible to anybody who needs it, even if they personally would not, you know, have an abortion or you know, don't believe in abortion. I think that's the beauty and the thing that's really special about of our community, that we seek to help each other. We really believe that we're there for our community members if they need us, and that again, we want the same freedoms and the same access to things that everybody else has, and we believe that should be upheld by our systems of legislation and policy. I think that's an important point to raise. We do face an undue amount of barriers and challenges to be able to have the same, you know, care and the same access to services that everybody else has.
I'm so interested that voter education, voter registration, election work is also part of your work. Why is voting part of reproductive justice work?
Well, voting is such an important part of this because we know that we have to manifest our power in the systems that we currently exist in. You know, I will say that at Latina Institute, we approach our work through a reproductive justice lens, really thinking about how we dismantle the systems of oppression that target our communities, and you know, again, keep us from being able to have the lives that we need or that we want. So it's so important for us to think about how we're participating in the systems that exist so that we can change them, right? So that we can dismantle them. We really are thinking about, you know, the next generation of folks who will take on leadership and really having them reflect who we are, what we need as a community. And at Latina Institute, one of the things that's really important for us is building power among our own community, you know, folks, regular folks in their homes, thinking about, you know, the way that these things affect them, really building their power to be able to fight for themselves, to be able to expand access to quality reproductive health care, to think about, you know, access to healthcare in general, to really think about all of the different intersecting issues that affect their their lives and to stand up to fight for them. We really believe that the future is about ensuring that folks who've been silenced and ignored have a seat at the table, drive the discussions in the future, and are taking the lead. So voting is just a part of that, but really our bigger focus is on building power and ensuring that folks use their vote, use every other measure that they have in their hands to be able to create change for themselves and their communities.
As you're thinking about that, building that power, what are the kinds of policies that need to be in place at both the state and the federal level to truly support reproductive health and justice for the Latinx community?
Well, there are so many things happening at various levels right now. And unfortunately, as I mentioned earlier, there are so many restrictions that have come up. But we're responding. So one of the things that we at Latina Institute are working on helping pass is the Women's Health Protection Act, which is a piece of legislation that would basically create a statutory right for providers to provide and people to receive abortion care free from medically unnecessary restrictions that single out abortion care. WIPA, as we call it for short, would overrule state laws across the country that unnecessarily restrict abortion, like the bill in Texas, SB4, which is another bill that is going through, which restricts medication abortion. So if this passes in the Senate, it just passed the House last week. We can see, these kinds of terrible pieces of legislation that are just intended to curb access dismantled and go away. So we're hopeful for that. We're also really interested in the Heal for Immigrant Families Act, which would expand access to healthcare for everyone living in our country, regardless of their documentation status. And as I mentioned earlier, one of the things that we think about a lot is that not everybody who lives in our communities has the same access. Even if we were to say that restrictions are gone through the Women's Health Protection Act, or many of our community members, especially those who are undocumented or have different immigration statuses, don't have access. And so we really want to get at that with the Heal for Immigrant Families Act. So those are just a couple of things. I know there are myriad pieces of legislation in different states that are supporting and expanding access to care. And we're really interested in that. We're working on something in Virginia called AREA, the Reproductive Health Equity Act. So there's so many different things happening, but we are, that we're trying to balance with responding to some of these retrogressive pieces of legislation in the states.
Where do you find hope? What is a space or a place where you've seen things actually moving forward, where we've seen some, and even if that hope is just in the work that you all are doing yourselves, where do you find it?
I think absolutely. I find hope in the poderosas, as we call them, that work on the ground in Texas and in Florida. Get a little bit emotional thinking about them. They are on the front lines, the ones who would be most affected by these pieces of legislation or who are the most affected. And yet they're resilient, they're on the ground and speaking up for community and really relentless in their fight. And so they give me a ton of hope. It also gives me hope to know that so many in our communities don't want to see this turning back of the clock on reproductive healthcare or healthcare access. That we are the majority. And we see that time and time again. And I think we're getting to a place where I think that power of our collective majority will manifest in a better world and a better policies for us. But I really think that knowing that and hearing that from the perspective of all of the activists that we work with across the country, and again, seeing the everyday work that our communities are doing to fight back, despite, again, being the ones who are the most affected, is really moving and giving me lots of hope for the future.
Lupe Rodriguez is the executive director of the National Latina Institute for Reproductive Justice. Lupe, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you so much, Melissa.
That's the show, y'all. And we've spent an entire hour discussing women's rights and women's health. So we can't leave you without mentioning the fact that R. Kelly, a man who violated so many young women and had such a devastating effect on their lives, was found guilty yesterday in New York. A jury found Kelly guilty on all counts, which included racketeering and sex trafficking. Tomorrow, we'll be speaking with Dream Hampton. She's the executive producer of the docuseries Surviving R. Kelly, a project which brought the allegations against Kelly back into the national conversation and helped ensure his survivors finally had their day in court. Also, if you have any thoughts, any feelings about this R. Kelly verdict, we want to know. So call us at 877-8-MY-TAKE. That's 877-869-8253. Or send us a tweet at The Takeaway. Thanks so much for spending part of your day with us. It means more than you know. I'm Melissa Harris-Perry, and this is The Takeaway. Talk again tomorrow.